Welcome back to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Henry Price. I am joined by Brandon Hansen and Chad Bird. Fellas, what's going on?
Hey, everybody. Good morning. Good evening. Whatever time you're listening. Glad you're with us.
I'm looking forward to getting into this.
All right. All right. So, yeah, let's just, we'll take care of some, we have some conference announcement kind of stuff. We'll maybe do that at the end, but for now, what if we just jumped right in, Chad?
Let's jump in. Chapter 35 of Genesis is where we're at today. We are actually coming pretty close to wrapping up the story of Jacob. Most of it is wrapped up in this chapter. The next chapter, which we'll spend probably about 30 seconds on, chapter 36, is all about the genealogy of Esau. So after that, the story of Joseph begins, which is a huge section of Genesis. I can't wait to get there. Should be some good discussions about what happens to him. But anyway, back to chapter 35. To remind us where we're at in the story, last time we talked about the rape of Dinah and aftermath that occurred there. You may remember that Jacob and his family were living near Shechem, and Dinah, his daughter, was taken by the prince of that city. She was held captive. She was raped. And two of her brothers, Simeon and Levi, they tricked all the male inhabitants of the city into having themselves circumcised so that they were not able to defend themselves. And then these two brothers go in and slaughter every male in the city. And a couple things to remember about what happened there that are significant for chapter 35 is first of all, now you had a whole bunch of people who had not been part of Jacob's family brought into the clan, because after they killed all the men in the city, they took their wives and their children as loot, living loot. And they brought these foreigners into their own families. That's going to become significant right at the beginning of chapter 35. And another thing to remember is that there was some strife between the dad and his sons, between Jacob and his sons, because Jacob more or less takes an approach to this of being silent, wanting to smooth everything over. He doesn't come to his daughter's defense. And his sons, the brothers of Dinah, are upset by this. And we're going to see where this family strife comes to the surface again toward the end of chapter 35 in an incident that relates to Jacob's oldest son, Reuben, and something that he is infamous for doing. So kind of bear those couple of things in mind as we start out here with chapter 35. So all of this has just happened, and we shift in chapter 35 from the speech of the brothers to their father to the speech of God to Jacob. So Jacob's been living with his sizable clan by now, close to Shechem. And God says to him, beginning of chapter 35, he says, get up, go to Bethel and live there and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. So already in this opening verse, we have a pretty big theme that's introduced that becomes part of the rest of the chapter. And that is that everything kind of gets recapitulated and gets revisited in this chapter. Jacob's flight from his brother Esau, his overnight stay in Bethel, where he had the vision of God and the angels ascending and descending. That's referenced here. We're going to have the giving of a new name to Jacob, revisited later in the chapter. He goes to Bethel, and he also follows the same route that his grandfather Abraham had followed when he first entered the land. So this chapter kind of pulls together a lot of the past events. It revisits them, recapitulates them, and reinforces the promises that God had given to Jacob. So he says, get up, go to Bethel, and live there. So he's wanting to get him out of Shechem because they've committed this massacre at Shechem. And of course, everybody, all the inhabitants around there are going to know that. Jacob is afraid that he's going to now become the victim of attacks, reprisals from the allies of Shechem. So God says, get out of there. And the real interesting part, for me anyway, happens immediately after God's speech. So God says this to Jacob, and then Jacob turns around, and this is what he says to his household, and it's to his household and to all who were with him. So it's his family, but it's also to these survivors of the massacre at Shechem who have been, I guess you'd say, adopted, even though that really doesn't seem to be the right term, but brought into the families of the sons of Jacob. Here's what he says. Put away the foreign gods which are among you, and purify yourselves and change your garments. And let us arise and go to Bethel, and I will make there an altar to God who answered me in the day of my distress and who has been with me wherever I have gone. Now, what's amazing about this is that, you know, we've been following Jacob for a long time now. We followed him from infancy to adulthood. We followed him from his father's household all the way to the land of Padan Aram, where he married his two wives and two co-wives and had the sons and daughter. And God has done all of these things for him. And now we get finally to this point, and still Jacob has to tell his household to get rid of the idols. So despite the fact that God has been with Jacob, he has blessed him in so many ways, despite Jacob's often objectionable or outright sinful behavior, and yet his household is still clinging to the false gods or to the idols which were among them. It's very similar to what happens at the end of the book of Joshua. If you remember Joshua chapter 24, of course, this is after the Exodus. God has brought the Israelites into the land. He has given them victory over a large majority of the population there. You know, he's worked these miraculous victories like the one at Jericho where he brought down the walls. He's basically handed the land of Israel to them, brought them out of Egypt through the Red Sea. So they have this whole history of Yahweh's devotion to them. And yet, in chapter 24, Joshua, after God has done all of this, Joshua has to tell them to get rid of the gods that they are still clinging to. He says, this is Joshua 24, 14. He says, put away the gods which your father served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And then later in the chapter, he says, now, therefore, put away the foreign gods which are in your midst and incline your heart to the Lord, the God of Israel.
Man, I am really glad that I have never put away an idol and got a different one.
You have been exclusively devoted to the Lord your God.
Dude, when
every day of your life.
When I laid down my idols, that was it for me, man.
Yeah.
Never again.
Yeah, you and me both. I mean, once I devoted myself exclusively to God, then I no longer struggled with believing, trusting, and fearing Him above all things.
Nope. Been checking that box ever since.
We're waiting for Brandon to reprimand both of us. call us both bald face liars.
I'm right there with you. Now, I say that, of course, and I'm sure that you're saying it tongue in cheek.
Yeah. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I saw this, and I was wondering if you're going to point it out. The crazy thing is what he does with them, you know, because here's the thing. It's like, we do this so often and we think, I'm going to destroy these idols, but we find a way to get back to them, and over and over and over. I mean, here's excuse me, wrong in the throat. Here's Jacob, who wrestled with God, who God said, I'll call you Israel, changes his name, and it's going to happen again here. And like, you'd think that by this time he's going to just like, let's destroy these, let's turn them to powder, let's get rid of it and never again. But what he does is hilarious. He hides it all. Like, maybe I might have to come back to these. So even he's not, like, innocent in this. Like, you might be able to make the argument, well, Jacob didn't have the eye. These are just his family and his friends or whatever. It wasn't Jacob. Jacob was pure and innocent and holy. But no, he's like, here, we'll just bundle these up in a sack and hide it under the terebinth tree. We're going to go to Bethel, but we know where these are going to be if we ever have to come back to them.
It's good to have, you know, it's good to have a second option just in case the whole Yahweh thing doesn't work out.
Yeah, yeah. We can crash and burn. You got to have a parachute.
Yeah, we can always go back to the terebinth tree and dig them up.
Use the gods again. Yeah, I had a guy tell me once. He's like, yeah, I mean, I get what I was talking about, how we were all, you know, we all have idols and all this stuff. And he goes, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but, and so I knew that he was about to say something super profound, but these are like actual idols. And we would never do that. I mean, we would, like, it's not like we have like idols made out of gold. And I'm like, you sure about that?
You checked your bank account recently.
Like, what do you think that like Federal Reserve thing is? It's supposedly a bunch of gold somewhere, bro.
Yeah, like we don't have physical objects in which we trust. Yeah, physical people. Yeah, that's a stretch.
We all have idols, but ours isn't shaped like a snake. No, yours just has like pictures of dead people on it. It's way better.
Not nearly as bad. Oh, hey, let's read a little bit of Luther here, since we're on the subject of idolatry and what constitutes idolatry. If you guys who are listening have never ventured into the Large Catechism, it's some good stuff, and it's basically what. In this section, anyway, Luther's taken each of the commandments and he's delivering a sermon on them, expanding on the simpler meaning that he has in the small catechism. But here he's talking about the first commandment, you shall have no other gods. And he's asking the question, what is it to have a God? And here's his answer. A God is that to which we look for all good and in which we find refuge in every time of need. To have a God is nothing else than to trust and believe him with our whole heart. As I have often said, the trust and faith of the heart alone make both God and an idol. If your faith and trust are right, then your God is the true God. On the other hand, if your trust is false and wrong, then you have not the true God. And then he goes on later, just a couple paragraphs later, to say exactly what you were saying, Dan. He's talking about popular idols. And he says that such a man also has a god, mammon by name, that is money and possessions, on which he fixes his whole heart. It is the most common idol on earth. So a god is that to which we look for all good and which we find refuge in every time of need. And it certainly can be a god in the heart. It can be accomplishments. It can be our own abilities and whatnot, but very often it's something quite physical, just as physical as these gods of gold and silver were to the people in Jacob's household, or to the rings that they had in their ears as well, as we'll hear in just a minute.
Yeah,
it is also worth pointing out, as we perhaps have before, that the first commandment, you shall have no other gods, is really the only commandment. I mean, there are 10 commandments, but when you boil it all down, there's only one. Because if you have the first commandment down, the rest of them are easy. If your fear and faith and trust are in God alone, then you're never going to misuse his name or forget his Sabbath day or dishonor your parents or commit murder, adultery, or steal or anything else. But the reason that we sin is because we don't get the first commandment. The reason we sin, commit any sin, is because we break the first commandment. And we cling to our idols, or we put them aside, like Brandon was saying. We bury them so that we can come back to them later on.
We're like this. Somebody comes in. Is that an idol? No, I am not currently worshiping that.
not at the time.
I mean, I know where it is. and I've got it. But no, I'm fat. I'm not currently worshiping that particular thing. Yeah, that's what that is.
That's the way we work.
Well, that's exactly how idols work. I mean, it's idolatry is to try to clean yourself up, to try to make yourself better for, you know, the, in that way, we even turn God into an idol, because here Jacob is saying, put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves, change your garments. Like, we're going to look really good for God. When we get there, we're not going to look like this shabby train wreck that we are right now. We're gonna be pure and
holy. We're gonna have our church clothes on.
Yeah. 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 You know, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, Jesus says, you know, he talks about, like, when they ask him what's the greatest commandment, and he says, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, right? Mm-hmm. Then he says, and then he just tags on there for good measure, the second is like it, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. But then he says, like, but that's really all you need to know. Like, he's, yeah, like, the whole law and all the commandments, they all rest on that. Like, you do this, you're good to go.
Yeah, that's all you need.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's done.
Love does not belong to the neighbor. Love never ceases trusting in God. So, yeah, if you got those, if the head is right, everything else follows. If it's not, everything else goes to pot.
Yeah, yeah. If you got love down, the rest of it is just happening.
Yeah, without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
But when you don't have love right, then everything else goes wrong. And you end up serving yourself, more or less. You end up making of yourself an idol in which you trust and love.
The real work of the true religion here that I see going on is when God does appear to Jacob, and he names Jacob, and he says, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. And he does God to Jacob and to this fledgling nation of Israel. This is where, you know, I was saying that Jacob was making God into an idol. And that might sound a little strange, but that's where he says, I'm going to do the work to make us holy. But then God comes in and places his name on Jacob, names Jacob, calls Jacob his own, and then says to Jacob, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, and speaks, and in his speech acts and creates for himself what is good and holy, and creates in Jacob, where there is nothing lovable, something that he loves. A nation and a company of nations shall follow you, and kings shall become your own body. He speaks, and thus it is. And this is true religion, to receive from God versus, all right, I'm going to clean myself up. I'm going to make it all good, right, and holy. We're going to look good outwardly, but that's nothing, because the inside's still rotten. The idols are still sitting back there under the terebinth tree. God's got to come in and really make any change that's actually going to matter. And it's not something that I do or that you guys do to yourselves, but what God does to us.
Amen.
Yeah, amen. Yeah. Yeah, the mistake that Jacob and his household could easily make is that what's important is what they did. Yeah, we're bearing these gods. I mean, we're not going to have them with us when we go up here before Yahweh. And we're going to change clothes. We're going to do all this stuff. I'm going to build an altar. And that's what is really important. And then God comes along, and he appears, and he speaks. He reminds us, like you were saying, Brandon, reminds us of what is truly important. Is his word of blessing, his pronouncement of a name change, his promise of future blessings that will come to Jacob and to his posterity. That's what matters. It's his speech that determines that gives a holiness to Jacob and to his family, gives them the blessings. It's not anything that Jacob or his family half-ass do on their way to Bethel. So we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but that's good.
Dude, you know, I just have to say this just because it's one of my favorite things in the world. You know who really knew how to get rid of idols?
Who's that?
Moses.
Yeah, Moses
did. Here's what's up, guys. You got an idol? If Jacob wanted to really roll hard, when Moses caught you with an idol, when the law catches you with an idol, he melts it down, grinds it up, and makes you drink it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of my favorite episodes from Exodus.
Oh, I could be worshiping false gods in here, huh? You're going to drink it.
You like this god so much? There you go. Drink it down. Dude. Yeah, that's what happens to the golden calf.
That's what the law does.
That is what the law does. You like this god so much, it's going to be down your throat. See how you like it then.
Yep.
In light of that, all I can say is that's coming up, but it hasn't yet. And that's where we think that's what we should really do. I mean, if hiding them under the terebinth tree, I mean, nice try, Jacob. But what you should have done is grind it up. I mean, I just basically had said that a little bit ago. But the thing is, like, that's coming, but it's not there yet. We might think, like, why, God, did you not lead out with the grinding it up and making the people drink it?
Right.
Well, all I can say is thank God that he comes to us as we are. Otherwise, I mean, we never get to the point where we get the law and that exposes our sin. He's a God that comes to us in our need, who comes to us to make us holy, not before. And yes, before we are.
Well, when you're like radically unrepentant of your idolatry, or just of your lack of, which is idolatry, your lack of trust in God. God does have a sense of humor about these sort of things. Even, I mean, I think that there's things in Exodus, which we'll get to someday probably, that are hilarious. I mean, yeah, that's one of them. Like, grind it up and drink it. So God's like, here's your idol. You want this? I'll give it to you. He does the same thing when they're like, you know what would be good? Some quail. He's like, you have quail coming out your nose.
You'll be puking up quail. I'll give you so much.
Yeah. He does. All right, fine. That's what you want? I'll give it to you until you can't stand it anymore.
Yeah. Well, that is often what the wrath of God feels like. Him giving us exactly what we want, right? That's Romans 1. Yeah. God gave them over to what they wanted. Yeah. So very often the wrath of God feels like this overabundance of what we enjoy, which then ends up, coming out our nose. We get sick of it because it ruins our life. There are few things worse that could happen to you in life than to get an overabundance of that which you especially desire, because usually that ends up being nothing more than our own destruction.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't sin like this? I could just have a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Not realizing that's death. That's the chaos of the overabundance of it. And God is, he's just like you said, Chad. That's what you want? Okay. All right, I'll give you over to that. And then we're like, oh no, I didn't want all that. I didn't realize it was like that. And God's like, well, that's exactly what it is.
Well, there's no such thing as a little idolatry.
Yeah.
I'll have the idolatry appetizer sampler. But no, man. That's not how it works. Like, there's idolatry.
Taste test. I just want a taste test. That's really all I want.
So we go sample all the different idols. There's idolatry, and then there's true worship. That's it. Like, there's no... is that idolatry? It's like a little. It's a little idolatrous. It's a puss. No, that doesn't happen, man. It does not happen. There's no point in scripture where God's like, my people are a little idolatrous. You know what? They're right on the edge of idolatry. No. It's like when you're idolatrous, like suddenly like you're a complete whore. That's what it is. It's not like you seem to be
like a one night stand.
No,
yeah, you're all in.
No, it seems like you're kind of getting flirtatious with that God over there.
Yeah,
that's how it goes.
That's all or nothing, black or white.
All right, where are we at? We derailed.
Yeah, that's all right. We're sort of working our way toward Bethel here. They make this just so they, after we have the hiding of the gods, then they make the journey toward Bethel, and it is interesting that Jacob's fears were completely unfounded. He was afraid that when his sons massacred the city of Shechem, that You know, they were going to be in danger. Well, it turns out now everybody around them is scared to death of Jacob and his family. So they journey along, and there's a great terror upon the cities which were around them. And they didn't pursue the sons of Jacob. Evidently, these other cities did not hear exactly how the sons of Jacob conquered the city of Shechem. I mean, they wouldn't have been able to conquer it had not all the guys been suffering from the pain of 3 days after circumcision. But that was not known to the other cities. So they're scared to death that Jacob and his family are, you know, a bunch of great warriors who will destroy them should they pursue them. So the journey's in peace. They came to Bethel, and Jacob does what he said he's going to do. He builds an altar, calls the place El Bethel, which is kind of a strange name, means God, the house of God, because Bethel already means the house of God. So El Bethel is God, the house of God. This is the place where God had revealed himself to him at the beginning of his journey. So this everything has now come back full circle. Jacob leaves with nothing. He spends a night. He just has the staff in his hand. He spends the night there with a rock for a pillow. God appears, promises he's going to be with him, promises that he will bring him back. Jacob says, if you do, then when I come back, then I will return here to Bethel. And here he finally does. And we have a little parentheses here, a little side note that I think is worthy to comment on. Verse 8, it's kind of strange, actually. It says, now Deborah, it's like thrown in there. Now Deborah, Rebecca's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the oak. Now, why in the world will that be mentioned? Well, we don't know for sure, because it's pretty rare that usually if a woman's burial is mentioned, it's because she's the wife of a patriarch. I think the reason it's here is because Deborah is kind of taking the place of Rebecca, if you will. Rebecca, evidently, at this point, has already died. She died when her son was exiled for those 20 years. Isaac is still alive, but Rebecca is not. And so her closest servant, Deborah, who was given to her when she married Isaac, her death is recorded, and her burial is recorded, because this is sort of a way of the Bible marking the passing of someone who was significant to the life of Jacob. This is the first of three deaths, by the way, that's going to occur in this chapter. First, Deborah dies, and then Rachel dies, and then Isaac's death is recorded at the end. So they get to Bethel, and God appears to Jacob, just like he appeared to him earlier, except this time without the whole ladder and the angels ascending and descending. And he re-gives the name that he'd given to Jacob earlier. He says, your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. So he's reinforcing what he already said on the night that he wrestled with Jacob. We have the name change from the heel grabber to the one who fights with God and man and prevails. Then he goes on to once more reiterate the blessings that he had already promised to Jacob. He says that a nation and company of nations shall come forth from Jacob, king shall come forth from him, and the land which he gave to Abraham and to Isaac, he now gives to Jacob. So this is God's way of, once he's brought Jacob home, of giving him the word again. Reiterating what he's already said, reinforcing what he's already said, as God is always doing with us. You know, it's not enough for us to hear once what God has said. You know, it's not enough to hear the gospel one time, and then the rest of our life, hey, we're good. We need the constant reinforcement of the promises of God, because we're forgetful people. And so God says it over and over to us. This is who I am. This is who you are. This is what I've done for you. This is what I will continue to do for you, so that his words are the words that are bouncing around inside our head on an ongoing basis, as opposed to the lying words that work their way in. This is what happened at Bethel.
Yeah, if you've got any Jacob in you, then yeah, you need that constant reminder that, hey, you know how everything looks like you're this? Well, you're not, you're this. God does that to us all the time. Hopefully he does it to you, depending on what church you go to. If you've got a good one, hopefully he does that to you like every single Sunday and reminds you that I've called you this, I've named you this, I've made you this. I know the last 6 days in between services have seemed to be saying otherwise, but this is who you are. You are forgiven. You're my son. That this is what God does. It's why we constantly need the gospel pounded into our head, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he basically says the same thing to us that he says to Jacob. You know, we're born with a certain name. We're born with sinner for a name, and God comes to us and says, you shall no longer be called that, but your name shall be Christian. Your name shall be forgiven. Your name shall be a child of God and a brother of Christ. And without that constant giving of these gifts, not just reminding, but a constant giving of these gifts through his word, then we believe the lies that other people tell us. We believe the lie that we tell ourselves, because the volume of accusation and shame and guilt that we experience on a daily basis, it's pretty hard to drown out. So God comes along and he shuts it up with a word that speaks truth, that you're forgiven, that you're my child, that nothing and no one will ever change that. And then he promises us the same thing that he promises Jacob, that he is our God, that he is on our side, and that all his promises to us are sure and certain, and nothing is going to take those away. Yeah. So our Bethel is when we gather around that word of God to hear what he promises to us over and over. So that's what happened in Bethel. Kind of move on here, and we've got a few minutes left. See what happens next. So they didn't stay in Bethel. I don't know why, because God told them to, but I guess Jacob had other ideas. They journeyed from Bethel, and they went south. They were moving south. They start at Shechem. They go to Bethel. Then they move to Ephrath. And then all of a sudden, we're not told this ahead of time. All of a sudden, we find out Rachel is pregnant. Now, this is amazing, because as you remember, it took her forever to get pregnant the first time. Her sister was having all these babies. And finally, Rachel resorts to giving her maidservant to Jacob so that he can sleep with her and have babies. And then finally, Rachel has a child, Joseph. But now we find out that she's actually pregnant again after all these years. And it says that she goes into labor, but things aren't going well. It says that she suffered severe labor. She's in great, great pain. And her midwife says to her, "Do not fear, for now you have another son," which is exactly what she wanted. She named him, her first son, Joseph. And the reason she named him that was because she prayed that God would Joseph her with another. He would Yasaf. He would give her another son. And finally, she gets that. But ironically and sadly, this will be the last child that she has, because she dies in childbirth, not before she gives him a very depressing name. I guess in the midst of her pain, in the midst of her impending death, she named the child Ben-Oni, which means the son of my sorrow. Ben means son, Oni means sorrow, something like that. Then she dies, and Jacob changes the son's name. He didn't want the child stuck with a depressing name, I suppose. So he changed it to Ben-Yamin, or Benjamin, as we say, which means son of my right hand, or the right hand is a symbol of dominance, of power, of blessing. So it's not just like, oh, he's going to be a right-handed kid. It's the right hand in the Bible is the symbol of success and power and majesty and regalness and all of those things. So Benjamin's given a great name. And Rachel dies, and she is buried there on the way to Ephrath, which was another name for Bethlehem at the time. So Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel dies, and she is buried on the way to Bethlehem. So let's move on. We got a little bit of time left. I want to cover this last this last little part because it's significant. So one of the reasons that Rachel's death is significant is because now her maidservant no longer is connected with Rachel. And what happens to her maidservant then becomes important, because we're told that they go on, they settle beyond the Tower of Eder. And then in verse 22, it says this: "And it came about while Israel was dwelling in that land that Reuben," that's Jacob's firstborn, the son of Leah, "that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it." Now, I learned something about this morning. I knew this before. I knew what Reuben had done, that he had slept with his father's co-wife. I don't know if you call it incest or not, but certainly pretty close to that. But what I learned was something which I had never considered before about the motivation for what Reuben did. Now, I'm not discounting lust as a motivation for any sexual act, but as we all know, lust is not the only reason that people have sex. There's other motivations as well. And one that seems to be very much of a probability here is that we have multiple biblical examples of someone sleeping with either his father's or his predecessor's concubines or co-wives as a way of asserting that he is the one who's now in charge. For instance, when Absalom's son, when David's son Absalom drove David out of the kingdom, when he staged the coup and drove David out, he slept with all of David's harem as a way of saying, "I am now the man. I'm the one in charge." So he slept with his father's co-wives, with his concubines. The same thing happened with the son of Saul. One of his generals slept with Saul's concubine as a way of establishing dominance and saying that he's the one who's now in charge. And so I suspect, at least I wonder, if maybe that wasn't what was going on with Reuben here. It wasn't just like he saw the concubine, he seduced her, but rather this is Reuben's way of saying, "I'm the one who is," it's like he was usurping his father's authority by sleeping with his father's concubine. And I wonder if part of this does not have to do with what we talked about in chapter 34, because the brothers are very upset with the way their father mishandled the whole situation with the rape of Dinah. They thought he was passive, hands off, and the brothers wanted to defend their sister. And so Reuben possibly is wanting to say that I'm the one who's now in charge. Dad can't handle the situation anymore. And so he's wanting to establish himself as the one who is the alpha male of this clan.
Which, by the way, is the most messed up way to do anything ever. Like, "All right, guys, thing that happened to our sister, that was messed up. That was real messed up." Like, you know, when, like, dad basically stood by and, like, let this horrible thing happen to her. "I'm going to go hook up with this concubine."
Yeah.
Okay. All right, then. Yeah. Righteousness is prevailing.
Isn't that the way we often work, though? Yeah. You know, sin was terrible. I'm going to do something about it. And we end up sinning in a different way to do something about it. Right?
Or in a very similar way. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how much say this concubine had in this whole thing. But it seems like, okay, so listen, my sister was unjustly taken and slept with. I'm going to go sleep with my dad's concubine to make it right.
Yeah, totally righteous act there.
Just, we are weird creatures, man.
Yeah, we are very, very creatures. Yeah, you wonder if part of this wasn't simply revenge as well. Whatever his motivations were, we're actually not told. It backfired big time because Reuben was the firstborn. He was the one who was supposed to receive the blessing of the firstborn. But in chapter 49, on the deathbed of Jacob, he references this act on the part of Reuben. And because of that, he withholds the blessing that should have gone to Reuben and passes by him. He passes by Levi and Simeon, who were next in line because of what they did at Shechem. And then he goes to the fourth son, to Judah. And it's upon Judah that he pronounces the blessing, the messianic messianic blessing,
which is still hilarious to me also, because Jacob's like got like a real he takes birthrights and blessings very seriously. Yes, and like who's worthy of them, and making sure that he's like, listen, man, birthrights and blessings, we can't you can't have any shady business going on when you're dishing these things out. Everything needs to be on the up and up.
You guys were totally deceptive when you told the people of Shechem to be circumcised, and we are not giving the blessing to somebody who is deceitful. That's not the way this works.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, Jacob. Yeah. Talk about a man of contradictions.
Jeez. But, dude, we're out of time. So
that's it.
Nice positive note to end on. I hope you guys feel good. Try to reference back to that whole renaming thing going on. That would be a better way for you to exit. Hey, Christful Fast is listener-supported stuff. If you like this podcast or any other stuff that we do, you can help us out by going to christfulfast.org/support, and you can make a one-time donation or a reoccurring donation, and that would help us keep doing what we're doing. Also, we have city events, Christful Fast city events, conferences, that are coming up. They're one-day conferences. We've got one in New York City on June 11th, and we've got one in Dallas October 29th. So if you are in either of those areas, you should come out and see us. But if you want more information about those things, if you're interested in hanging out with us and you're in either one of those areas, then go over to ChristWillFest.org, and you can go to the city events, and you can get the information there. All right, we've gone long, so we'll see you next week. We'll be right back.